This episode is part of our ongoing series with NI Connections, where each month we have the chance to sit down with someone interesting from Northern Ireland who's living and working overseas. To find out more about our global diaspora, listen to previous episodes in the series and sign up for a free monthly newsletter. Please visit niconnections.com. Thanks so much, and really hope you enjoy today's conversation.
What do you mean you're a robotic eater?
I think a lot, if you ask my friends, they tell you that I do not see food the way other people see food.
Okay.
That I just see it as fuel.
Yeah.
So that's probably where the robotic came in. For, I can't remember, maybe a couple of years now, I've sort of taken more of a robotic approach to it, where certainly this year I will have the same meal for lunch and dinner every day.
Yeah.
Monday to Friday.
Yeah.
And that's for a couple of reasons, financial as a startup founder, and then sort of, you know, what's in the calories, the macros and all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you're getting the right stuff in it.
Yeah.
And just for out of habit, so I don't have to like think about it and decide. It's just one less decision or two less decisions are there.
It's like the Zuckerberg wardrobe effect. That's not the official term for it, but you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Or the same thing, and you don't have to make that decision that day, I suppose.
That's it, yeah. I think it goes far back as Einstein, maybe he said that, and Steve Jobs, another, they did a lot of that. I'm not consciously like channeling that.
You're following the footsteps, bro, let's do it. So hit me then, what's your go-to lunch, your go-to dinner? Because I'm always looking for, I eat pretty much the same two meals every single day, and I'm always curious. Because like, for me, it's all about the macros, speed and price.
Yeah.
Like taste doesn't really come into it. Like my go-to is actually like lentils and tuna.
Okay.
And then my other one is like eggs and black beans.
That sounds very wholesome.
In a can, in and out, boom, 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 boom.
Okay. I feel like we're kindred spirits then.
What are you rocking?
It is, so I'm sort of vegetarian. I went vegan a couple of years ago, but I stray. So I wouldn't call myself vegan these days.
Yes.
I stray into chocolate cakes, basically.
We're only human.
Yeah. This is why all this like robotic eating comes in, is because I'm an absolute glut the rest of the time.
Yeah, you got to cage the monkey somehow.
Yeah. So my go-to at the minute is two Linda McCartney veggie burgers in salad, basically a mixed leaf salad.
Perfect.
With some French dressing.
Yeah.
That's it, lunch and dinner.
Awesome. So we usually kind of start off with origin stories, childhood sort of stuff. Gonna fast track a wee bit and hit you with something like family growing up. Ever grow anything? Was that like part of your environment when you were a kid?
Not fruit and vegetables, strangely enough. My dad is a big gardener.
Yeah.
But so he keeps our sort of front and back garden in Belfast in proper good condition.
Yeah.
Like it looks like a landscaper's been out there. You know, he was out yesterday, he was out this morning in the good weather. But so it's always been flowers and hedges and trees and stuff. So he's very well versed in all that stuff. But it was just something that was always going on. It wasn't really where he's like, come here, I'll show you this. He would just sort of talk about it in passing.
Yeah.
So no, the fruit and vegetables never really happened for me growing up. It was something I came to later in life. In fact, it was whenever I didn't have a garden at all. That's when I started looking at it.
Yeah, you always want what you can't have.
Exactly.
You? I remember we lived for, was it 3 years? On the Donegal Road and like a two up, two down terrace. And I don't know, you maybe lived in a similar sort of environment where you didn't really have a back garden. You just had like a wee like concrete space where your bins were.
That's it.
And I remember always thinking like, oh mate, should I put raised beds in here or something? Do you know what I mean? You're and I love seeing the balcony growers. It's almost like the more constraints that are on it, the more creative people get.
Yeah,
it's
absolutely. Really cool. Absolutely. Yeah. That, I mean, it's very much the same for me. I think I started with like a little salad bowl growing out of a teapot. I bought my girlfriend like this Nordic tea set, which she said was nice, but then never touched it. So well, I'll turn that into a plant pot.
I mean, that's like every nice piece of not cutlery, what do you call like the collection of like
it's homeware, vaguely. I don't know what the specific,
all good homeware has to live in the cupboard, it can never actually be used.
This is displayed but it's never actually touched.
So what made you start to grow in the teapot?
I don't know. I think I had seen allotments and stuff in the area where we lived in London, but I just had no idea how to get involved in them. And I think, you know, it was it's certainly like coming from an architecture background, there's a lot of talk about how you can use space and how you can, you know, build communities and how you can and be more sustainable with space. And so it was just something that interested me. It was around that time actually that I changed the more kind of plant-based diet. So it was just a bit of a catalyst from that.
Cool. Yeah, you need to figure out how am I going to get more plants into my system.
Yeah. Here? I mean, I went, if you talk about robotic, I went from a proper meathead to 180. So like that, I had like a bit of a last supper before I changed over and I went to a chicken shop and bought everything, like the dirtiest chicken shop down the street from us in London.
Yeah.
And changed from there. And so I thought, right, I got to have to fuel this vegetarianism somehow.
Yeah. Were you always big into training or did you play sport or anything like that?
I played water polo when I lived in Belfast, strangely. And then I moved to New York after my undergraduate, and I thought, and I played a year of rugby in school, but I was always more of a water polo guy. And then when I was moving to New York, I thought they're going to be great at water polo and terrible at rugby. So I'll jump to rugby.
Yeah, let me optimize.
Yeah, little did I know, I turned up at the team and they had a big South African coach, a French backs coach. Oh. They had full of expats and Aussies and Kiwis and stuff. So it was terrible. But it was great crack. It was the best decision ever made because I got lifelong friends out of it as well.
So is that how you ended up selling fruit and vegetables in Queens?
That is, yeah. It was one of my friends from the rugby team. He and his brother basically bought a refrigerated van and they were just absolute hustlers. They would just do anything to make money. Any business idea, they would just act on it. So I kind of learned a lot from them. And they had known these sort of friends of the family farms in New Jersey, just across the river. And so they drive around to them and pick up as much as they could get. And it was really good stuff. It was brilliant. Like a lot of it, you could just eat raw on the street.
Yeah.
And that was some of their sales techniques. It was just like showing the New Jersey sweet corn and like ripping it open and taking a big bite into it in front of like your would-be customers on the street. So they just basically, there was one stand that was set up outside an Italian restaurant in the Upper East Side. That was my friend's older brother. Then my friend Harold got involved. So he started setting up a stall in Queens, which I later took on. They found a third stall in a flea market in Long Island City.
Epic.
And each of us would just drive from stall to stall and sort of distribute all the veg to one stall, leave him, go to the next one. So I had to drive in my friend's Jeep and follow the refrigerated van.
Brutal.
And they drove like absolute psychopaths
maniacs.
down, you know, Manhattan, like bumper to bumper traffic. And he'd be cutting across four lanes in his big truck. And I'd be following him, just being like, sorry, you know, being a bit more apologetic. I just remember it was during a heat wave as well, funnily enough. And I remember one time I was always the last person to get sort of my stuff distributed. And they chuck massive bags of sweet corn out the back of the van to me in the drenching, you know, sweaty heat. And then the last thing that go out was always the watermelons, these giant watermelons. You'd be chucking them out and it'd be absolutely like shouting at me like, come on, we need to go. And I'd be like trying to catch like two watermelons at a time and put them into the and set up the stall at the same time. And there was one point where he just threw a couple at me and I dropped it. We both just paused for a moment and looked at it and it just looked delicious in the heat. So we just stopped and sat on the sidewalk and just
that up.
Absolutely tore into it. So brilliant. Good.
I feel like that's like, I lived in New York for 3 years in Manhattan. And I feel like that type of business is like pure business. It's so territorial as well though. Like I hate to make the comparison, but like, and I'm not saying this was what you guys were like, but like a lot of the fruit sellers we would know, it's almost like being drug dealers. It's like you've got your block and like no one else can infringe on your block and like you're really, really hustling. Like it's not a case of like, oh yeah, I just have this like little fruit thing. It's like really, really intense. Like you really have to push hard to make it work.
Yeah, I think it was interesting. I think they found little niches in the neighborhoods. The one I was in Astoria. So there's a big...
I lived in Astoria, wow.
Oh, that's really? Crazy, I mean, yeah. So you know, like, you know, a big kind of Greek community, like lots of Italians and just lots of random sort of, you know, nationalities in it. And I think there was a real sense, it was the most sense of community I ever felt living there.
Yeah.
Because people, especially during the heat wave, people come up and buy me bottles of water. So people invite me up to dinner in their apartments nearby. And it was outside an Italian restaurant there as well. So... Mm-hmm. There was a bit of a partnership there and they'd come out and give you pizza, you know.
That's awesome.
It was really nice. I felt the love from the community.
Why did you go over there again?
So initially I went as part of my sort of architecture career. Perfect. I went over for like a internship, essentially.
Yeah.
I didn't have the internship whenever I left to go there. I just kind of packed the portfolio in the suitcase and went out. And we have some family out there. So I stayed for about 2 months on my second cousin's sofa. He also ran a nightclub and a music venue over there. So I ended up working there part-time. And so I did that for a year and worked in an architecture studio sort of downtown Manhattan. It was brilliant. So usually you take 1 year out between the sort of undergrad and postgrad of architecture. I sort of knew I was going to take 2 years out, but I didn't know what I was going to do with the second year. My visa was only 1 year. So I ended up coming home and just working in the Apple store in Victoria Square where I'd done during uni. And making a bit of money again. And then when it came to what I was going to do for that year, I sort of applied to internships in Europe, but they were always going to be unpaid again. I thought, I can't do another year unpaid and like absolutely, you know, hustling to work day and night just to make ends meet. So I ended up just going back to New York, and I knew Harold would have a space for me. So I would figure out the kind of money thing once I was out there.
So good. I feel like everyone needs to have a summer like that. You know, like, and it is like, if you go to New York, usually what is it you end up doing? Either work in the pubs, or there's like a really strong like Irish diaspora bicycle connection.
Oh yeah.
You know, all the like the bikes around Central Park.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's like Irish mafia. It feels like, I mean, it's like every other person is like some sort of connection to Northern Ireland or the Republic.
Yeah. It's mad. I think I remember one of the first few weeks just being in a pub to watch like a rugby game over there and just chatting to Irish people. And through a connection, they just get you a job behind a bar somewhere.
Yeah.
And then it's the sort of thing where people go, oh, yeah, we can actually get you a social security number as well.
You need a passport, bro? You're like, no, I'm good.
Yeah. Yeah.
Awesome. So you got into architecture. You enjoyed it. You seem to have like quite like a design oriented, like even like train of thought, which I guess is important. Why'd you leave?
Yeah, I don't know that I would have left if I didn't start doing Allotme. Yeah. It's interesting. I always sort of wonder that, would I still be doing it now?
Yeah.
Because I always sort of, when I was going through uni and was working in practices in London more recently, if you'd asked me, I would have always projected, oh yeah, I'll be an architect in 10 years time or 20 years time. But really, it was during... So the third part of architecture you have to do after the postgrad is to get the professional qualification, and you get the legal title of architect. It's actually the only thing that's like professional, as a professional, is protected under the law. It's just the legal title architect.
Oh, well.
So you could go and practice architecture right now and do the exact same job as an architect if you were trained to do it.
Yeah.
But just not call yourself an architect, and that's the only difference. So as part of that, getting that professional qualification, I went to London Metropolitan University. So you do that while you're working. And after I finished it, they sent around an email basically for a startup competition. So sort of like an early accelerator. And it was really just a concept. And so I had one vague idea about some sort of, you know, abstract architecture kind of center, which I didn't end up submitting. And I had an early idea for Allotme, which is just, let's have a platform to manage allotments as they are currently.
Wow.
And I submitted that into their social impact category. You go through kind of rounds of pitching and, you know, refining the idea in workshops in the accelerator. And then there's like an external judges panel. And so I ended up winning the social impact category, and that set me off down that path.
Yeah.
Really, I only did that, you know, in my spare time.
That was like an extracurricular.
Yeah. It was like a bit of a channel of the extra sort of creativity.
Yeah.
And it was only during lockdown that I saw, you know, at the time it was just a website, a holding page, a landing page with a waiting list to sort of gauge the demand.
Yeah.
And it was only during lockdown where I saw the demand absolutely spike up.
Oh, interesting.
Because, of course, there was so much sort of press articles at the time of people absolutely loving their allotments, or the demand increasing by like 400%. And I saw those same trends happening just on the Allotme website.
What were your search terms? Do you remember?
It was just always, you know, find an allotment, find a vegetable garden, find a plot near me, you know, that kind of thing. And there wasn't really any advertising I was doing at the time.
Yeah.
So people, you know, I was amazed that people were still finding it and signing up
for a landing page. It's incredible.
Yeah.
Wow.
So that really sparked me off, and thought, at the time, you know, people were going on furlough from their work, and I didn't look like I was getting furlough at all. Like I was deep in the trenches in my job at the time. I remember actually, this is probably what helped me kind of shift away from architecture at the time. I was working on this roof detailing package. So designing the sort of roof buildup of these massive blocks of housing in London. And I was sort of by chance became the roofing expert in my practice, which is not where you want to be. And so I asked for furlough from my practice and said, you know, I want to give this a go. Can I see how it goes for 3 weeks? And they basically gave me that, the minimum and maximum amount of furlough, no more.
Yeah.
And so during that time, I figured out how much I could really get done with it.
Yeah.
And then started to negotiate with my office. There was a bit of a precedent of some people had, you know, maybe kids and they'd work part-time or a couple of days off a week. And the most they were willing to give me off is one day off a week. Yeah. And that wasn't enough for me. So then the first day back from furlough, I handed in my notice.
Wow.
And just took the plunge, really.
Class. Very, very cool. I think like the early seed of your idea is really interesting because, again, like I'll just go back to Donegal Road. Like there's a wee hidden kind of park across the bridge. There's like a primary school and there's a whole bunch of allotments. You really wouldn't know it was there unless you were looking for it. And I always remember walking past there and just being like, how the heck do I get one of them? Do you know what I mean? Like it seems like some sort of like mysterious, mythical, like how do I get on the other side of the fence?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? No number, no nothing. Like I'm sure if I really looked, I could have found it.
Well, that's the thing. Like I was exactly the same with the plot in London that was near our apartment. And there's nothing. You go on the council website and it's a pin on a map. And if you click on that pin, it tells you the name of the allotment. But there's no contact details. Crazy. There's no information about the waiting list. The truth is that for the most part, they don't want you to know the information because the truth is that the waiting list is full. Mm. And in fact, for the one near us, it was over 10 years long.
Oh my goodness.
So I always thought, well, like young people move to London all the time, but maybe for 5, 6, 7 years at a time.
Yeah, it's a transient city for most.
And they're never going to join a 10-year long waiting list. Yeah. So I always thought, well, whatever these figures that are coming out about how many people are on the waiting lists, it's probably the numbers are soft in comparison to what the demand would be if the information was accessible to most people.
Well, that's the thing, yeah.
And like, or if it was, you know, in keeping with how we order a taxi, how we order food, how we order accommodation when we're traveling. So I thought, in the first instance, let's make it all accessible. Let's make it in line with consumer demands.
Make it shiny.
And then, of course, you quickly realize it's not going to actually solve the problem.
Yeah.
So that's when it sort of opened up to, okay, what is an allotment? Mm-hmm. And that's where we're about to do this kind of summer marketing campaign, which is called Allotment 2.0. And it's like, okay, a back garden. We've had plots that are listed from church grounds, you know, ones in schools, ones in traditional allotment plots as well.
Yeah.
But the bread and butter is just like somebody who's got a bit of land, whether it's their front or back garden.
Yeah.
So that's when it really opened up.
That's so cool, man. Very, very cool. So traditional allotment industry, if we can call it that, you're renting that. You take out a long-term lease on that or how does that work?
In it. Typical old school allotment, you'll get a plot and you'll have it for life.
What?
So that's why they typically don't get passed on.
Oh my goodness.
Some are more strict about it. The thing is that it's, for the most part, the rules on it are completely devolved to all these tiny little regions and allotment associations around the country. And sometimes it's a parish council that runs it.
Yep.
So it's proper old school. But it really stays with a person for life. And that's why the waiting lists are so long.
That's crazy.
And typically the land is super undervalued as well. Yeah. I mean, it's great that it's so affordable for the people that have had it for that length of time.
Yeah.
But the problem is that land set aside for allotments has declined by like 65-70% since their peak, you know?
Yeah.
And the reason for that is because they're not valuing the land accurately. Mm-hmm. And so big developers come in and it's easy for them to make a case to take over the space.
Yeah.
So yeah, in London, it's probably a little bit more realistic where other people are paying maybe £200 a year or something.
Yeah.
But I'm sure there's ones around Belfast where it's sort of £40 a year.
Yeah.
It's like, it's absolutely nothing, but you can often get like, you know, 50 square meters or more. Mm-hmm. And 50 square meters is the average size of a one bedroom apartment for building regulations. So it's like, you're getting that for £40 a year and you have a tenancy for life. It's well, no wonder the land is sort of being squeezed away.
Yeah.
Now, probably people from traditional allotment societies don't like hearing that, mm-hmm. but the truth is that they're declining. They're rising in demand, but they're declining in supply. So something has to change.
Yeah. And you got in, you know, a lot of people are kind of talking about like a grow your own kind of revolution. And there's loads of really interesting companies that have even been on my radar recently that are getting into this sort of space.
Mm.
And I don't know, for whatever reason, like, was it the good weather? Was it the extra time? Was it becoming slightly more health conscious? But like lockdown really like started that or accelerated that massively. Like even in my own life, like never once have I cared if I go to the butcher versus if I go to Lidl.
Mm.
Or if I get my eggs from the farm shop versus Lidl, you know yeah. what I mean? And all of a sudden start thinking about these things, you know, and like I've had you've caught me on a really good day. Like for my lunch today, like I had potatoes that I grew myself.
Nice.
I had a salad that was all grown from our garden with just like, do we even have four raised beds? Like it's a really, really small piece of land that we have
mm.
in terms of stuff we grow on. But I mean, like, the value it's brought to our life is inexplainable.
Yeah, it's
like,
crazy.
Even the art of like, or the art, the joy of going out and like picking a few nettles out or watering it on a really hot day, it's like so therapeutic. And then you get to eat it.
Yeah.
It's like a hobby that like gives you something back.
Yeah,
you
know absolutely. I think that like the catalyst of lockdown was such a crazy thing because for me, I think it was that it showed people that your behavior could change.
Mm.
You were forced to go indoors. You were forced to do all these different things, wear a mask, clean your hands more often. So people were starting to question their day-to-day habits and routines. So that was a big thing. So they're thinking, okay, I'm stuck here.
Yeah.
What could I do with this space? So lots of people did, you know, did just like yourself.
Yeah.
And yeah, as you say, not only eating the food, but actually the practice of it. Like yeah. I love going out in the hot weather and just watering the plants and just standing there with a hand hose and
yeah.
and just watching them.
Yeah.
You know, creating rainbows by
spraying yeah, exactly, in the air. Exactly.
And yeah, as you say, it's so cathartic to watch mm-hmm. something grow and like, you know, you've got, you know, young kids.
Yeah.
But for me it's like they're my children. We would have pets even. So what, you know, nurturing something, watching it grow, maintaining it. It's teaching you life lessons yeah. along the way.
Like I'm gonna like make a big statement here, but I absolutely back myself. Like watching the potatoes grow is easily one of the most incredible things I've ever experienced in my life.
Yeah.
Like you put a potato in the ground, and I know it's so basic, yeah. and like it just turns into this massive thing.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you've got like 10 potatoes, 12 yeah. potatoes from it. You're like, that is carnage.
Yeah. I think, and the more and more that like young people come around to this sort of thing, you realize that it's the answer to probably a lot of the problems that younger generations are experiencing.
Yeah.
So not only is it just the joy of watching something grow and getting something back from it, but like my ambition certainly with Allotme is that a lot of technology just kind of draws you further and further into more technology.
Yes.
Like my ambition with Allotme is that, okay, it's a bit of technology, but takes you out of technology.
That's really interesting. You know, the other person who I've heard say that is Sarah Fryer.
Oh, yes.
She's CEO Next Door.
Yeah.
And I really, really, I love that sentiment because I'll say it for what it is. You know, like most of big tech's goal, as you say, is to bring people in.
Mm-hmm.
And I love to see people that are using technology to like push people out.
Yeah.
Because we need pushed out now.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the tables have turned where we actually actively need incentives to like put the screen away.
Yeah.
And so I love that you are like leveraging the tools of technology to enable people to do that.
Yeah, hopefully so. Like we won't know that for a good while, how successful sure. that is. But I think the more access we can give people yep. to those spaces, then they're going to get out there and get their hands dirty.
Yeah.
And like as well, just, you know, you said yourself that the mental health benefits of doing that. There's so much studies that are being done at the minute to verify those kind of trends and beliefs that how beneficial it can be. But they say, you know, 2 hours a week can have a drastic increase in your mental health and you know, removal of those things of anxiety and depression.
Yep.
So
yeah. Well, I mean, even the color green in and of itself, like amazing studies like done in major cities that like in areas where there was less green, like the suicide rate goes up.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like, or like being outside, like even throughout winter, like I, you know, put my raised beds in through winter and like you're outside doing relatively labor intensive work, you know, mm-hmm. like shifting like large amounts of like material around. And, you know, I was outside way more this winter than I would have been otherwise. like outside of like running and training and stuff, but just like in my everyday like housework sort of life,
it gets you out.
It forced me to go out, and I reaped the benefit of it.
Yeah, there's lots of little triggers that you get from vegetable growing that makes you appreciate certain things about life that you usually don't like. So even, you know, rain.
Yeah. Like rain.
Rain, yeah. Which of course is a big thing here and in Scotland, like where I've lived before, you know, having a different perspective on rain and actually going, okay, great. I don't need to water today necessarily. Yeah, so that's great. Yeah. The plants are going to enjoy that.
My babies are going to love this.
Yeah. Like that is a big key change in your mind to have. So there's so much.
It's amazing. I'm going to get off this for soon, but I just love, the other one I love is radishes.
Oh yeah.
Radishes just explode. Like 3 weeks, they're done. You're like, how is that even legal?
They're pretty quick, yeah.
They're so fast.
I've seen a lot of people use radishes as markers. So where you plant things like parsnips, which take a long time to mature. So you put radishes like, in between your parsnips so that you know where the line of parsnips is.
So smart.
And then you get your radishes pretty quickly,
of course. Yeah, you can grow. You can take your radish and then the long-term crop will still grow. So where are you currently at? Are the lots, you've like lots up and going?
There are, I think there's probably somewhere between 120, 130 or 40 have been listed on the site.
This will go out in a couple of months, so we'll call it 200.
right now we haven't done any marketing at all. It's great that there's plenty of sort of press outlets that are getting in touch and they want to write about the case studies of people that have actively been using it. And so when we launched a year ago, it was more about the idea and the concept and getting it out there. But now we're able to go back to them with the stories of our users. So people who have been, in some cases, have been using it for a year and are getting the benefits of it. And it's great to hear the stories of young families without a garden at all, with just a balcony or something like that. And they're taking over a space of maybe somebody older or maybe somebody who just has a busy job.
Yeah.
And hearing the stories of, oh yeah, I bring my dad down sometimes, or I bring my young child, they run around, and those relationships that form between those. So, you know, the sort of community that you tend to hear about in traditional allotments, you know, we can also build that in a kind of microcosm on plot by plot basis. So it's going well. You know, we've just fundraised as well quite recently. So
what did you need to raise?
So I think quite naively, I set out to raise 150k to kind of get everything going and make a hire at least of one software engineer to really work on improving the platform. In the end, we raised 250.
Nice.
So there's three of us sort of working on a full-time basis. We're just about to bring on an intern as well. So the team is growing and the user base is growing quite organically, which is nice to see. And I think there's a bit of word of mouth that's happening now with it too. But we're still getting inquiries from lots of different press outlets, the Evening Standard this morning in one of the London papers. And there's a BBC show that's got in touch recently. So I think for me, it was always going to be, it's not about just selling the platform and saying, look, here's where you can find a space.
Yeah.
It's about telling the stories of our users, because that's what's going to make it hit home for most people and make them realize, you know, where the benefits are in it, because it's all great being, you know, saying in abstracto, you can decrease your carbon footprint and improve your mental health.
But when
you hear the story of somebody who's actually lived that for a year,
then
it makes it so much easier to sell.
Again, like, you know, like the creative potential in terms of the stories you can capture is incredible.
Yeah.
You know, like I think if, again, some of Nextdoor's campaigns, I think of some Airbnb's campaigns, and you have that lovely thing where, yes, there's like a tangible thing and a goal, which is, okay, we want to grow vegetables or fruit or whatever, like on this space in this garden. But then there's the relationships that come alongside that as well. Like the potential there in terms of human impact is really lovely.
Yeah, I think I really love some of the Airbnb sort of comparison. It's one that's done to death, of course, in the startup.
Yeah.
Industry.
But actually, I think in your case, it legitimately makes sense. You know what I mean? Because you have the host, you have the guest as such.
Yeah.
And you are the platform that brings the two together.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. It's a pretty easy parallel to kind of help people get their head around what we're doing. Of course, the difference is that Airbnb are kind of global supply and demand. We're local. And they're short-term relationships, and we're really building for long-term relationships. Totally. But I really love the some of the marketing campaigns that you see them do, where it's as a host, you could say, oh, this is, you know, renting on Airbnb has allowed me to pay for X, and like, that's great. That's really gets, you know, it's a tangible benefit. It's not abstract. And yeah, those really sit with me well.
Cool. So, I mean, I imagine like all startups, there's like constant iteration. Things are probably being tweaked and evolving all the time. You're somewhat in the prototype stage and you're testing the market and figuring it out. So currently, let's just say, like, walk me through. If I, you know, okay, I'm living on Donegal Road. I see that there's an AllotMe site near me. What happens next? And specifically, I want to know, like, let's say I'm renting somebody's garden. Is it up to me to then just, like, I just do whatever I want with that garden? Like, do I have to put raised beds in? Can I dig someone's grass up? Like, talk to me a wee bit more about, like, the actual details. Yeah.
Yeah, so I think because it is a long-term relationship that you're building, like, trust is key. And what's most important in trust is transparency. Mm-hmm. So if you're a host in the first place and you're listing your garden on the site, we want really as much information as possible so that you can give that information to any potential renter. So how it's accessed, for example, is a big key thing. So is there a lockbox? Is there a side gate? Or is it street access if it's a front garden? And then all the kind of amenities that go with it, storage, access to water, tools, that sort of thing. And also an access, like, does the host need to be there when you're there? So that's the sort of basic format at the minute. We're this week, in fact, hopefully by the end of this week, we're going to release our sort of version 2 of the platform, which is
awesome.
Which will just be a lot more information, which is pertinent to the people who are going to be renting it. So how ready is it to be planted?
Yeah.
Do you need to build raised beds or anything like that? What are the highlights? Is it south facing? Is it a peaceful space? Is there parking available?
Yeah.
So just presenting as much as possible. And then, you know, just making sure that the photos that the users are putting up in the plot accurately represent it, making sure that the hosts are active on the site. So if you do list your garden, you know, if 2 weeks later somebody requests your garden, you're going to actually reply and respond. So that's the sort of next stages of it. In terms of the day-to-day, it's really because it's between both parties, that agreement needs to be there. So what we tend to see is that for the most part, people will do viewings before. So that's probably where the difference between Airbnb and us is people will go down to the site like they're buying or renting a flat or something. So the next part is also building in that viewing bookings into the platform so that you can, as a host, you can say, okay, generally viewings are available to be done these evenings and this day. So it's kind of like Calendly.
I love Calendly. Oh my goodness.
It just makes life a lot easier. So I think, you know, we're basically going to have to build a version of Calendly into AllotMe though. So it's a bit of it's a bigger engineering task than it sounds.
Yeah.
But I think it's going to have tremendous benefits for people because typically, a lot of the work that we're doing in the first instance is a response to user behavior on the platform. And for me, calling up hosts and green fingers and saying, okay, how have you found it? Was there anything, any feedback for us? Yeah. And so most of the time we've already sort of built in the stuff that they've given us. But viewings is one of those bigger engineering tasks that is, it's on the pipeline for the next couple of months.
It's very interesting. Yeah. The stuff you discover as you go into it. Very, very cool.
But the sort of basis of AllotMe is this site where you can find a space to grow your own food is the foundation of it. And it's the bare bones. But really, what we want is to have it as so much more as really to be the home of urban agriculture. Mm-hmm. So I think for the most part, if you ask an average person on the street, where are you going to go to find out more about growing your own food or what's your go-to website or app or anything, they'll probably each give you a different response. It's like, oh, I'll go to the Royal Horticultural Society, National Allotment Society website, which are quite, they're 90s websites. They're not built for the modern era.
And their target market is predominantly senior citizens.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
and I can say, like, as a recent green finger in your language, I have really struggled with the education piece, where do I go? And I'm all over the place.
Yeah.
I'm like trying to something like radishes. When do I pick my radishes? There's like 20 different answers. I'm like, I just want the program to follow. Just give me a solution. Yeah. Like, give me a killer app that I can just do it all in,
Yeah, absolutely.
So you've great opportunity to kind of become like an educator and a thought leader in the space as well?
That's it. I mean, so at the minute, there is a section on our website where there's where you can click to narrow down the type of vegetable based on the season, or if it's a root vegetable or herb or something, and then it will give you, so literally I've trolled through YouTube and we find our favorite growing guides for each of them, and then awesome. There's a step-by-step guide. So you can go on. I think it's just, it's about.allotme.co.uk/growing.
Yep.
So it's on there currently, but it's really just the starting point. Like, we want to be kind of like, you know, maybe if you're a runner, mm-hmm. as you're saying, you probably use Strava.
Yep.
Yeah. So if you can imagine what Strava is to the communities of runners and cyclists who are really tight knit and really active in that community, those communities already exist in vegetable growing. They just don't have a place yet. And that's what we want Allotme
to be. Give the tribe kind of a place to hang out.
That's it. We want Allotme to basically be the Strava for vegetable growing.
Yeah.
So that you can get your answers there. You can track, okay, I planted these seedlings on this date, so I know that I'm going to need to take them like this. You can get badges. Maybe we can have partners come in and do giveaways for different tool sets if you've, you know, grown the best radishes. So some of that's maybe a bit more subjective than running a, you know, a sub 25K or something. I think it's a great parallel to kind of demonstrate that, the you know, giving, as you say, giving a community a place to be.
Yeah. I'm going to ask you like a ridiculous question here because I think it's impossible to know. A two-parter, like, would you like / can you see Allotme going global?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean...
And do you want to be the person that leads that the whole way?
Mm-hmm.
Or do you have an idea? Do you have a desire? Sorry, do you have a desire to be a CEO? Or do you have a desire to like focus in on like a specific department or a specific role, or be a hands-off founder? Do you want to be a hands-on founder? How do you think about that at this stage?
Yeah, I think... Well, I'll try and answer that in the order you give it. So in terms of it being a global, you know, a global website or app that people use, I was always slightly cautious or worried maybe that even the name Allotme wouldn't be something that would translate globally, because allotments are very much a kind of Western European term.
Yeah.
And even like if you go to America, they call allotment a homestead basically. Mm. And it's different around the world in some places. But whenever we did the launch, you know, there was a couple of big press publications that picked up the story, including like The Guardian, The Times and things, Huffington Post. And it showed that there was actually a demand for in these places. So we've had lots listed in Argentina, Germany, Italy, Spain, East and West Coast America.
Awesome.
And they're really just like a couple of little pins in the map. They're it's small so far, but it's great to see that the concept does actually travel.
Yeah.
So for me, yes, it's absolutely something that could be global, because why not? You know, it's the sort of thing where if you've got a high density urban environment, it's always going to be a problem where there's a lack of space. And certainly the trends and population trends are going that way. So like in the UK, 75% of people already live in cities.
Wild.
But in London, for example, it's something, I can't remember the stats, but it's growing like 9% a year.
That's carnage.
And, you know, across the globe, I think they're saying that by 2050, 70% of the population will be living in cities. So we're kind of ahead of the trend on urbanization, but the rest of the world's going there.
Oh, it's coming, yeah.
And it's interesting because COVID brought in the question, is that trend going to continue? Yeah. Are people going to move away from the cities? Is New York City
dead? I remember there were big article drops about that.
It's crazy. Yeah. But those are the short order effects.
Yep.
You know, the third order effects is that people start to actually question their day-to-day habits. Mm-hmm. But certainly if you're a young person, you want to move to a city typically. Yeah. And that's how these cities grow. And then some people end up staying. So, I definitely think there is an appetite, and like there will be plans in the future to, as long as things keep going well, to go internationally. At the minute, we're focused on where the problem is the greatest, which is London to begin with, mm-hmm. and the other high density urban cities. So it'll be like Birmingham, Glasgow, Belfast and things will follow.
Nice.
Second question is if it will be me at the helm. At the minute, I don't really see it any other way.
Awesome.
I know that there's always sort of question of whether, you know, young founders bring in kind of adult supervision and to take over as CEO. It's a sort of term I've heard in the sort of Silicon Valley startup world. And I know people like the Gymshark founder, he went off and was the head of maybe marketing and brand or something like that for a couple of years, and he had somebody take over as CEO. Then he grew back into the role of CEO.
Nice.
At the minute, we're so small that, you know, it really feels, you know, the term CEO doesn't really feel suitable. Yeah.
You're like, let me get 20 employees first.
Yeah. So I don't really think we're at a point where that's a question I necessarily need to ask myself. But at the minute, my answer is yes, it'll be me for now, because there's so much that I feel like we still need to do on it.
Absolutely.
And there's, you know, I can project a couple of years ahead at least in terms of what we even just need to build on the platform to make it right for our users. So we just keep going.
That's cool. No, I'm projecting myself on you, Admin, because I've kind of like been thinking a lot recently. I'm like, you know what, man, like, I love to start things, I love to grow things, but like, I am not the CEO. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's just not where my skill set lies. And so I'm always curious to hear, even from the guys in here, Normal Bass, like, you know, there's so much creativity, there's so much opportunity, but how do you see all that growing and all that taking off? So I appreciate
it. I think in a strange way, architecture is quite a good training ground for like running a company, because you have to, as an architect, you have to wear many hats and you sort of have to be the designer, you know, you have to be a technician, you have to sometimes do graphics and presentations, you have to sell to, you know, the public and often to developers or clients or get things through planning. So, and actually, you know, starting off a building concept from the very start, turning it into something that's real, turning it into something that's physical and that people are using. Like, it's a great parallel for being an entrepreneur as well. So I think it's helped me in a funny way.
It's great, man. I always just love to hear how, you know, the earlier journeys you go on always just somehow prepare you for whatever's next.
It's, it's only when you look back that you realize that actually selling fruits and vegetables in the streets of New York, like that at the time, I would not have the wildest idea that that would some way inform my future career.
Yeah.
But actually looking back, it was probably the first time, I told you I was a big meathead before.
Yeah.
That was probably the first time where I opened my eyes and to start eating a range of vegetables beyond the day to day.
Yeah. Awesome. So starting to land the plane then, there's a couple of stock questions we love to ask everybody, and like, take these literally whatever way you want. You can go personal, you can go professional, whatever floats your boat.
Mm-hmm.
So first one is, out of everything so far, what has been the most challenging moment? And if you don't mind sharing, how were you able to overcome it or go through it?
Yeah, I think it's sort of a recurring moment. So I'll kind of maybe answer this in abstract. With a lot of me, it's overcoming the fear. Like, actually, I'll show you it. Like, my wallpaper, I've killed my phone. I'm a professional.
Yeah.
I have just two words on my phone as my screensaver. It just says "feel fast," and that's because I was so afraid in the very early doors of Allotme of actually even calling up users and saying, "Hi, I'm Connor from Allotme," because, you know, it's putting something out there in the world, and then people sort of questioning it, and I think it took me a long time to feel comfortable with the notion of calling people up and wanting to find the answer sooner. It was always, I think, in the fear in the back of my head was, if I don't know the answer yet, then it's not a no yet.
Yeah.
And I'm sure a lot of startup founders feel the same way, or even yourself in doing this kind of thing. Like, whenever you put yourself out there for the first time, that's when you first have the opportunity to fail.
Yeah.
And I think getting over that failure or the fear of failure is the biggest part, and it's still something that pops up on a day to day basis.
Sure, man.
And if it's, especially if it's something important, and it's, you know, this has got my name all over it, I am forever attached to it, you know, whether I like it or not. So, you know, it's very much intrinsic on getting over that fear of failure. So, I think, you know, your friends and family around you are definitely key for that. But I think just the practice, the actual day-to-day practice of getting over it is just by action. There is nothing else that will cure fear than action.
Mm. That is very, very true. Yeah, to parallel it with the podcast, you know, I mean, every podcaster says this, but you go back, you listen to like the first 100 episodes and it sounds like a different person, you know. But you only can go through that by doing it.
Yeah.
You know, like,
there's nothing else will cure it. Like there's no amount of deliberation. Yeah,
no, you can't think your way through it. You can't get better by mulling it over. It's like, you know, when I consult businesses who are looking to start their own podcasts or, you know, coaching other hosts, like we always just say publish makes perfect.
Yeah.
It's the only way.
Absolutely.
The only way.
Yeah.
Most successful moment or the proudest moment so far?
I think the proudest moments have just been when you hear the stories of the users. Mm-hmm. And that was always something that I was looking forward to, but I could never, you know, you can't force that. It has to, you know, they have to be out there in the garden using it for a period of time. I think, you know, I've had some proudest moments in my own vegetable garden of growing a big giant golden courgette. But,
come on.
But, no, I think just getting it out there and making it something that people are using. In the first instance, you know, we started really, you know, that sort of hustle culture of going door to door and trying to get people to sign up their gardens. Like that's how we started. I got all my mates in London that I bought them all an Allot Me beanie and we split up into teams and twos and just started rapping on doors. And like, is this going to be a reality? And that was before there was ever like a prospect of getting funding, before it was ever, you know, had software engineers in the team. It was all just hacked together and just trying to prove the concept. And I think that's a good training ground for it. Yeah, so man. I'm proud looking back that I've done that, because a lot of you hear kind of stories of, you know, Mark Cuban, you know, having done that and going and selling like garbage bags. That was his first, you know, thing before, and now he's a billionaire and he owns the Dallas Mavericks. So I think when investors have talked to me, you know, later down the line, I think I've been proud to say, well, actually I have gone back and done that. And probably, you know, doing the fruit and vegetables again, selling to people on the street, that's definitely been impactful.
Yeah.
In you know, having the, being able to overcome the fear of knocking on a door and saying, hey, you're not using this garden space. Have you thought about, you know, doing something else with it?
So good, man. What's your favorite thing to grow?
It's a sort of, I have two answers to this. The one is I would love to be able to grow well is spinach. And for just whatever reason, because I put spinach in most of the meals.
Yeah.
And I've tried in so many different formats to try and grow spinach. And it gets to a point where it looks like it's going to be a really beautiful plant. And then I go away for a week and the plant bolts.
Yeah.
Which for those who aren't gardeners, it means that the plant goes to seed. So it starts sort of preparing for the next season as opposed to giving you good leaves this season. So I can never do that. But the one my favorite to grow is tomatoes, because they're just so easy. They're so plentiful. Mm. They grow kind of steadily through the spring and early summer as well. Yeah. You know, you can really measure how well it's doing.
Yeah.
And this season, I think we've got hitting our stride with tomatoes, you know, like pruning the bottom leaves, nice, making sure there's no blight. Last year, we had a massive crop, but they all got tomato blight on them and just went to brown and went to hell. So I've been very careful this year, getting better.
Greenhouse, no greenhouse?
I've got a little sort of plastic covered greenhouse, it's more of like a staging area for the seedlings before they go out in the ground, just because there's not enough space in the flat to keep doing that. I have a little kind of germination station at the window in our living room, but yeah, my girlfriend hasn't thanked me for the amount of the amount that Allot Me has sort of bled into our flat and our living scenario. So I'm trying to kind of keep it well organized and stage them from inside. That's outside. Awesome.
The recent kind of heat wave, like I thought my tomatoes were done, and then the recent heat wave, like finally, I think, like brought them back, because I went away for a month. I was in Germany. I came back and they were not in good shape. So
okay.
I'll send you a picture of the final crop, but like they've started to like...
They're bouncing back?
Yeah, they're bouncing back.
I think that's the thing is as well, sometimes when you go on holiday and you come back, and there's various methods you can do, like getting a little bit of string and putting it into a big water bowl, all that sort of stuff. But it's quite nice to see that when you've got something, especially seedlings, and they go brown, they go withered.
Yeah.
As well, I've had some like aubergine plants and pepper plants recently that we've come back after like a wedding weekend or something.
Yeah.
And you think, oh God, they're dead. But actually, you just water them for a couple of days and they're good as new again.
Yeah.
It's quite nice to see.
Yeah. My salads, though, I mean, you talk about going to seed. It looked like a jungle, honestly. Really? I'll send you a photo when I go home. It was mad, like, because we were gone all of June, which is like prime time.
Right. So, yeah, you've got to kind of literally nip them in the bud.
Yeah. If you could take anyone from Northern Ireland, dead or alive, out for a cup of tea or a pint, who would you take? Where would you take them? Why?
Ooh. Tea or a pint? I mean, I'm sure this has been said many times. I'm going to go pint, and it's probably George Best.
Nice.
But I mean, I just love the George Best quote, which is, I spent all my money on sports cars, women and booze. The rest I just wasted. He's a man who knew what he was.
Exactly. Yeah, he's very true to himself, you know. Yeah,
so I'm sure he'd have some stories to tell.
Yeah, I bet he would. I'm trying to think who Gemma said. Can't think.
Okay, I must ask her.
Yeah, I can check afterwards, but off the top of my head, I couldn't tell you. All right. Is this us? Well, I'll do this one. Second last question. How have you seen Belfast or Northern Ireland change? Because I do think, like, when you go away, whether it's even for a summer or a few years to New York, obviously now in London for an extensive period of time, it gives you somewhat of a different perspective on the place that, you know, you grew up in and you called your home. How has that perspective changed over the years?
Yeah. Well, the funny thing is it has changed massively. I think, you know, I went to undergrad in the art college in York Street, and I enjoyed my time there. I think after that, I kind of knew I would go away in whatever capacity that would be. But since moving away, I've always, up until recently, I've always had the perspective that I probably wouldn't return to Belfast. But the more and more that I've lived away and I come home, I enjoy it more when I return. And of course, that's, that's as anything, like, you know, when you're not around it as much, you enjoy coming back to it. But more recently, I think if you'd have asked me, say, 5 years ago, would you ever return to Belfast? I would have said no.
Yeah.
And, you know, I love living in London. I love living in bigger cities. But now I think I'm really warming to the idea that it could be a potential. I'm not saying that I would be open to the idea of it now, whereas I wasn't before. And I think I always say to friends stuff, oh, every time I come home to Belfast, there's a new pub that's open. I have no idea where to go.
Yeah.
So I have to go back to the Duke, Ork and White's.
Yeah.
For a pint of Guinness. But so it's great to see the city livening up. You know, the cathedral quarter is one of those things. Like the University of Ulster moving down into the city. Like, I went to uni there on that street. To see it as this big built up, like, megla city, you know, it's crazy. But it's great to see at the same time, like, definitely I always thought there was so many sort of untouched parts of the city that were underutilized. And definitely as an architect, you kind of point at it and go, it could be so much more. And I suppose, you know, Royal Avenue being, you know, the main street in the city that doesn't have any pubs or restaurants on it. And that's obviously because of the Troubles and people didn't use the city center in the same way. But now as that's changing over time, I think it's really kind of unlocking what Belfast could be.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, places like this down the Ormond Baths, it's great. Like, you know, to see the sort of startup culture, you see the plans of the future going forward. And, I pitched at a H-Man event a couple of months ago, and hearing the other sort of startups that are coming through, coming up the roster, it's great.
Yeah.
Like, it's very exciting. I think if I was just, you know, 10 years ago and I was coming through, I might not have left at all.
Sure.
If it was like this today. So yeah, I think it's changing all the time. It's really exciting.
It's cool, bro. Final question then. If you could go back in time to a 18-year-old Connor, you had a few minutes of his time, what sort of thing would you say to him?
What would I have said? I would have said, don't worry, just keep going. I think I was probably a lot more self-conscious than I should have been at the time, and unsure of myself, I think. And yeah, weaving in and out of different personalities. So it sort of took me, I think, probably to midway through uni to figure out that I was actually, it was fine. I was all right. Just be okay. I think just keep going. Because I wouldn't, I often joke that if I chat to young people who are going to start in a career in architecture, I often joke, don't do it. Because architects are, there's a whole other conversation, but architects in society are sort of seen up there as one of those professions that your parents are proud of for you to do. And I think that is true. But society values the profession in abstract is not necessarily how society values the profession financially.
Yes.
So I think architects are very undervalued from a financial perspective. So that is a part of it. Mm-hmm. Seeing as you have to do a minimum of 7 years to become an architect.
That's the thing. It's like a lawyer. Like when you were talking about earlier about that like extra little bit to get the legal status. I was like, mate, this is like lawyer status here, man.
Yeah. I know, but then it doesn't actually ring true in your paycheck at the end of the month. Yeah. So I always used to joke to young people, don't do it. But for me, I think if I had gone back, even with the knowledge of that I'm no longer working as an architect, I would say still do it.
Yeah.
Because it's taught me so much. And I think as a, you know, like I said, being that kind of Renaissance man that every architect mm-hmm. needs to be, you know, where you learn everything before you do something more specific. It's a really great training ground.
Yeah.
And not just from a professional point of view, but just as a person.
Yeah. I'll give you one more bonus question. This sometimes is dead end, so like go with it. And if not, that's fine. First kind of like reaction or like first thing that pops into your head whenever I ask you, what's the kindest thing that someone's ever done for you?
I think there's something that popped into my head straight away.
Oh, bro, that was fast. Come on.
But it's one I think about sometimes. So it's, basically when I told you a story of me handing in my notice the first day back from furlough. The reason I was able to do that is because I had the confidence from my brother who sort of just said, well, you know, what's this all about? Like, why don't you do it? Mm. Just he said sort of, what's the plan? I think at the time I was talking about, okay, I'll move to another architecture practice or I'll take a bit of a sidestep. And he's like, why? You know, I thought you were sort of working on a lot of me. Like, what's going on there? I was like, yeah. He's like, well, would that be the goal to work on that full time? I said, yeah, absolutely. Ideally, that would be. And he just sort of said, do it then.
Class.
Do it then. And I think that was the first time. We're very similar. So it was the first time. It was sort of like me telling myself it. That idea became, you know, a potential reality. So that, you know, it's not maybe. Yeah, that's the kindest thing.
That's awesome. Matt, should I interview your brother as well? I mean, should I just, we're not your mom or dad. Like, I mean, should I just get everyone else on here?
Yeah. I mean, he's probably the most successful out of the three of
us. That's
but maybe, yeah. I mean, he's a corporate lawyer working in mergers and acquisitions, massive company. So,
class.
Yeah.
Very funny. Well, Gemma, thank you very much for recommending Connor. And Connor, thank you so much for your time. Appreciate
Pleasure.
It.
Pleasure. Yeah, mm-hmm. Great to do it.
Unbelievable stuff. Look, thank you so much once again for listening. My name is Matthew Thompson, and we're on a mission to share 350 conversations that celebrate Northern Ireland and the incredible people who call it home. Massive thanks once again to NI Connections for making today's episode possible. And like I said at the top of the show, you can find out more about our global diaspora, listen to other conversations in this series, and sign up to their free monthly newsletter by visiting niconnections.com. Other than that, hope you really enjoyed today's episode, and I look forward to catching you again soon.